Great. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm particularly appreciative of Dr. Kush and Dr. Kavanaugh for extending this invitation to talk about a topic that I like to talk to very much, which is to prediction and prevention of rheumatoid arthritis. We're having Dr. Karp and I will talk. Dr. Karp will talk later about lupus and preclinical lupus, but I envy the cardiovascular people with their risk models, because we're just trying to establish something along those lines in the preclinical stages of these autoimmune diseases. I have no specific disclosures except the funding that I've generously received from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. So we're going to have three objectives to my talk, the first being to summarize the results of current initiatives around the prevention of RA in individuals with autoantibodies in what has been called clinically suspect arthralgia. And the second would be to look at RA autoimmunity as and propose that as a point of no return, where we're really not able to do any prevention now with the tools we got. And the third, which is to acknowledge shared decision-making in developing RA prevention strategies. So we'll start with this case, which I think most of the people in this room will recognize. 46-year-old Caucasian woman is referred to the practice from a primary care physician's office. Urgent assessment for a suspected new-onset RA. She's got history of pain, stiffness in the hands, wrists, feet for the past 4 months, typical. All symptoms worse in the morning, an hour of morning stiffness. No family history of RA, smokes 5 to 10 cigarettes a day. Works in a fast food chain, frequently has her meals there. Exam reveals tenorous MCPs, wrist MTPs. Squeeze test is positive for the MCPs and MTPs. Reduced hand grip strength, no joint swelling. Double positive, strongly positive CCP and rheumatoid factor, normal CRP, hematology biochemistry. X-rays of the hands and feet are normal, unremarkable, and she's had a minimal response to over-the-counter medications. I think we'll all recognize these cases. So there's a number of questions around this case, and number one, does she already have classifiable seropositive RA? Two, if not, what is her risk of developing RA and over what time frame? Three, is there a role for further imaging, such as ultrasound, MRI? And four, of course, which is how would you manage her and what are the goals of therapy? And we'll look at that a little while, see what you think we should do. So the first question is, does she already have classifiable seropositive RA? These are the criteria that have been the most recent 2010 ACR Euler classification criteria. And you can see here that you get points for the number of joints involved, for serology, for inflammation, acute phase reactants, duration of symptoms. But importantly, you have to have at least one swollen joint. Okay, so she does not have any swollen joints. So she does not have classifiable RA. Now remember, these are classification criteria, not diagnostic criteria. But you can include her in your RA studies. So if she doesn't have classifiable RA, what's her risk of developing it over and over what time frame? So this brings in the concept of this clinically suspect arthralgia, which has really been championed in Europe, where on history, these symptoms of recent onset, MCP joints, duration of morning stiffness, an hour or more severe symptoms present in the early morning, first degree relative with RA, and on physical exam, difficulty in making a fist, and a positive squeeze test on her MCP joints. Now, she's got 6 out of those 7. The only thing she doesn't have is a family history. And if you look at the sensitivity and specificity of this being clinically suspect arthralgia, which is going to likely lead to RA, it's got 100% specificity. Obviously, low sensitivity because of the extent of the involvement. So at this point, I'd like to bring this kind of conceptual figure as to how I view the preclinical phases of RA. And, you know, everybody's got their, those of us working in the area, got their own figures. This one got me a lot of grant money from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, so I figured I'd use it. So you get this, the very first steps probably is some kind of of mucosal exposure. And we heard from Dr. Guma about the microbiome and so on. That's obviously playing a critical role. And you develop some autoantibodies, and the studies have shown that these autoantibodies are probably quite promiscuous. The anti-citrullinated protein antibodies, for instance, they recognize other post-translational modifications, so they can start out with a different post-translational modification, ultimately become targeted towards citrullinated antigens. Gene-environment interactions, but here we have this benign autoimmunity that becomes mature to become pathogenic autoimmunity. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. A third stage, which is there's through a bunch of environmental triggers, whether infections, pregnancy is an important one, stress and so on, that somehow the synovium gets targeted. From my perspective, it's likely a humoral target, immune complexes and so on. And then ultimately, we get this lifelong disease where the synovium itself becomes a secondary lymphoid organ producing autoantibodies and activated B cells and T cells and so on. Now, the patient we've described, as well as most patients with seropositive clinically suspect arthralgia, do have imminent RA. And so the disease onset is, the classifiable disease onset, is probably months away. And so the question I pose to you is this actually past the point of no return, where the prevention of RA is not currently possible with the tools we've got? I'll show you the evidence on that. So if prevention is not possible, what are the goals of pharmacologic therapy? Relieve symptoms, improve function, prevent structural damage, modify disease severity. All of these are certainly aspirations in treating early RA. Are they the same at this stage? So this is a very nice slide prepared by Sumaira Qureshi, working with Andy Cope at King's College in London, where she took all of the prospective cohorts from around the world, put them together, kind of did a meta-analysis, and put together this kind of survival curve of individuals who are just CCP positive with a family history of RA, CCP positive, and arthralgia, CCP positive and rheumatoid factor positive and arthralgia and so on. Our patient belongs in that bottom line there, the red line, which is CCP positive, arthralgia and positive rheumatoid factor. You see there at 2 years, 50% of these individuals will have developed RA. At 5 years, 70% will have developed RA. Is there any role for advanced imaging? Certainly a lot of these studies have been done in Europe, ultrasound, MRI, and there's quite a literature on this. There's ultrasound aficionados and there's MRI, and so you can follow the literature yourself. But I just want to highlight this one study which compared ultrasound and MRI at this stage of the disease. And you can pick up signals on both power Doppler signals, grayscale signals on the ultrasound. And then on your left, far left there, you can see the MRI with the lighting up around the tenosynovium and the synovium. And what the study showed basically is that the MRI is more sensitive at picking up tenosynovitis. This study looked at grip strength, reduced grip strength like our patient has, in two ways. One is the ability to make a full fist. The other is the actual strength of the grip. And compared it to the MRI signals that were seen, I just want to point out that tenosynovitis was very closely associated with loss of grip strength. Again, MRI was particularly sensitive at picking this up. Okay, so how would you manage her? You got a number of options there, over-the-counter drugs, lifestyle modification, get her to come back, give her some steroids, give her a methotrexate, hydroxychloroquine, a biologic. So let's take a vote on this. And do you continue with the conservative therapy? Do you give her a pulse of steroids, methotrexate, Plaquenil, TNF inhibitor, abatacept, rituximab, something else? Okay, just judging from the previous votes, once we get up to about 70 or 80, I think we're in good shape. All right. So We can see here that there's a lot of appetite for just being conservative. A quarter of the people would start methotrexate. A third of the people would start hydroxychloroquine. And then a smattering of individuals would go with biologics and so on. So the point here is that there's no right answer and it's all over the place. Say, we don't know what to do. So Room Now actually did an online survey, exactly as we did here, and asked, do you treat preclinical RA? And there were similar kind of answers. There's more conservatism expressed in the online because it was a more general question as opposed to specific to this kind of case. And again, not a lot of appetite for giving biologics and things like that. So if you want to go back and have a look at the results of that, it's quite interesting. So this is out of a recent review article, and it really shows you what we're trying to achieve with pharmacologic therapy. You want to treat for a period of time, and then you want to stop. Yeah, and we were discussing earlier on, it's like, what's the advantage of treating on and on, which is what we do for RA right now. The advantage of potentially treating at this stage is that you can treat and then stop. And you see in the top in red there, that's a trajectory, a level of inflammation. What you hope to achieve is during the treatment period, you go down to the green line, and it stays that way. Okay, that's prevention. But there's two other possibilities. One is that people get better during the treatment phase, and then they go back, that's the orange line, towards the top red line, and you don't gain much after you follow them. But the other possibility is the yellow line, which is you actually change the severity of the disease, which is an important consideration. We'll come back to that. So these are the studies. They're summarized here. An early study by 15 years ago or more now by the Dutch, where they gave some intramuscular steroid week one or 6 weeks, and then gave or placebo. And their outcome measure is whether there was any 50% reduction in the autoantibody levels. One person with placebo, one person with drug achieved that. But there was actually a reduction in the autoantibody levels, which persisted for up to 6 months. Nobody had RA prevention with a shot of steroids. The Prairie study, 1,000 milligrams of rituximab given and then follow after that for 2 years. There was a delay in the rituximab treated group compared to placebo, but everything looked the same at about 12 months. The treat earlier study is one with methotrexate, gave methotrexate 25 milligrams sub-Q weekly for a year, and then followed for a year after that. This appears in two places, one in the seropositive, which was the minority of these patients, and one in the seronegative at the bottom there, which was the majority. The inclusion criterion for that is that they had to have MRI inflammation in the joints and the hands and wrists. Two abatacept studies area out of a German group treated with sub-Q abatacept for 6 months and then followed them there. The primary criterion was MRI inflammation, which decreased as predicted. But again, they didn't show any difference or not minimal difference after follow-up in terms of the onset of RA. Apipra, which was presented by Andy Cope in San Diego, showed there was more impact on individuals with a fairly significant autoimmunity, and I'll show you a graph of that. But again, the lines came together disappointingly, but perhaps not as much as some of the other studies. And the STOP-RA, which is really disappointing, out of University of Colorado, NIH-funded study, hydroxychloroquine given to people, a third of them with symptoms, a third without symptoms, two-thirds with symptoms. It was stopped prematurely because of futility. RA looked like RA onset was the same in placebo and in the hydroxychloroquine group. That was presented in Philadelphia a little over a year ago. So this was the treat earlier, the methotrexate study on the far left. You see how the lines basically come together after the treatment period of 12 months, 24, they're basically the same. But if you look at the high-risk participants in this study, those with high 70% chance of developing RA, double positive, extensive MRI inflammation, there was nice separation, but again, coming back at while being treated, but coming back together at a year. And then here's stratified by ACPA status, and in the red and orange is the ACPA positive, and obviously they develop more rheumatoid arthritis than the individuals who are seronegative. But again, if you look at placebo in that group and placebo in the seronegative group, they come together at the end of 2 years. So this was the silver lining in that study, is that when they looked at HAQ scores, they looked at MRI inflammation, at 2 years off of medicine for a year, there was still a no convergence. So the HAQ scores had improved and maintained that improvement, as did the MRI inflammation. So the interpretation was that we may have generated milder disease, easier to treat disease, which in itself is an important achievement. This is the APIPRA study. You can see again coming together, but not completely in the follow-up period. And a point that was made by Dr. Cope and his colleagues is that in people who had appeared to have the most severe disease with the most autoantibodies, more autoantibodies, the separation was much better in the follow-up period than individuals who had lower levels of anti-CCP or had less isotypes of autoantibodies. Okay, just a word about the individuals who don't develop inflammatory arthritis. A study looked at that. You're much more likely to continue to have symptoms if you're seropositive compared to seronegative. A third of the individuals had resolution of symptoms. Two-thirds did not. And the individuals with no resolution tended to have more pain at baseline, which persisted. And then the MRI resolution happened in both groups. But again, some individuals in the no resolution symptom group simply had symptoms irrespective of what their MRI inflammation showed. Okay, so what would I do? And this is just because I'm standing up here. That's that. Based on that evidence, this is what I would do. I would bring her back in 3 months. If she's the same or worse, I'd give her IM steroids and start methotrexate 25 milligrams sub-Q weekly, if well tolerated, less if not. And then if she's asymptomatic at a year, I would taper the methotrexate. That's what the evidence tells me is the right thing to do. Lots of discussion, well, what about hydroxychloroquine? I think that's the best evidence right now. Okay, second case is one that we got from our own cohort of, we follow indigenous North American first-degree relatives of RA patients. We have for 2 decades looking at prospectively at the onset of disease. And this is a woman who was found to be CCP3 positive in the context of the study, first degree relative. She complains of occasional aches and pains, none that persist, no morning stiffness. Mother and sister had seropositive RA, smokes 5 to 10 cigarettes a day, homemaker, 4 children, tries to eat natural foods off the land. Exam reveals no tenderness, no swelling, good grip strength, seropositive for CCP at a good titer, 80. Seronegative for rheumatoid factor, normal acute phase reactants. So the question is with her, what's her risk of developing classifiable RA and over what time frame? Is there a role for a more advanced biomarker testing, proteomics, immunology, so on? How would you manage her and what are the goals of management? I will come back to that. Okay, so what's her risk of developing classifiable RA? And now we are dealing with this part of the graph, which is the more distal from the onset of disease. And here you've got a great heterogeneity. Some people with very early benign autoimmunity, some people with very matured autoimmunity, and it's hard to tell them apart just simply on the basis of their CCP levels. So is there something more we can do? And I emphasize that this is the population-based approach as opposed to the first case, which is you got the case from a physician's office. So how you get these cases makes a big difference as to what stage they're at. Okay, so on our graph here, this individual belongs on the very top line there in yellow. This is actually made up of our cohort and that of Kevin Dean's and the group at University of Colorado. And you can see here, less than 20% of individuals without arthralgia will develop RA in 5 years, as compared to the red line where the majority will. So this was the design of our study. First, we relatives of RA probands, so unrelated controls. We assemble this cohort and follow them longitudinally. And we published this a number of years ago. 18 progressors compared those to 356 non-progressors. And I'm just going to point out to you that the progressors were younger. They also had lower BMIs, not higher BMIs, lower BMIs. I don't know whether it's just an idiosyncrasy of our study or not. And nobody had type 2 diabetes, whereas this population has a lot of type 2 diabetes, as you can see in the non-progressors. As you would expect, at baseline, the progressors were much more likely to be autoantibody positive. But you look at the symptoms. We asked them, do you have hand pain, do you have stiffness, so on. You could not tell them apart, the progressors and non-progressors. There's a lot of noise there. And which of this represents clinically suspect arthralgia is an important question. But there was better separation if we looked at HAC, you know, functional scores, and the ACPA positive first degree relative had higher HAC scores than the ACPA negative, and those scores went up as disease approached in parallel with the increase in the ACPA levels. So when you look at the, to turn this into cases of inflammatory arthritis for 1,000 person years of follow-up, it's 4 for the double negative at baseline and the double positive at baseline, it's almost 100. So 10% of these people a year will develop inflammatory arthritis if you're double positive. But I show you this, and this was a surprise to us, which is if you take any individual at any one time point with their state, let's say double positive, ACPA positive, what's their likelihood of being in the same state next time you see them? And so you become seronegative or seropositive and so on. I'm just going to get you to focus on the bottom line there. After 5 years with baseline double positive, 40% will have developed RA, 40% will have reverted to a seronegative state. This is not a one-way street. We were surprised to see that, but that's what our data show. I propose that the maturation of the autoimmunity is the point of no return. And how can we tell that this autoimmune response is being matured? Here you see in the middle bar there, one individual at baseline, each one of those little columns in there represents a visit. And on the far right is an autoantigen matrix done by Bill Robinson at Stanford, multiple citrullinated endogenous autoantigens, clustrin, fibrinogen, bimentin, so on. And as you can see at RA onset, there's a dramatic increase in the amount of red compared to baseline. This is the phenomenon of epitope spreading, which the immune system does for a living. And if you convert that to a score, you can see here the important take-home point is that increasing anti-CCP levels is an indicator of increasing epitope spreading, more endogenous autoantigens, not just an increase in one specificity. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the glycosylation state of the ACPA is very interesting, both in the FC, which determines how it interacts with FC receptors, and Georg Schett's group has showed that this is dependent, sialic acid content is dependent on IL-23, IL-17 pathway. And then we became very interested with the group in Leiden on glycosylation in the antigen binding part of the immunoglobulin, and showing, in fact, if you had lots of carbohydrate there, your risk of developing RA, you've got a hazard ratio of 6 compared to those who have ACPA but don't have glycosylation in the variable region. And you can see most of this is happening in the preclinical stage, and it stays fairly stable when they develop disease. Did a proteomic approach. What else besides autoantibodies? This is from my colleague Liam O'Neill. We started out with 1,300 proteins in progressors and non-progressors. We did a bunch of machine learning, and you can see in panel A there with great accuracy, 23 of those determine who's going to progress. You can see you can nicely separate the progressors from the non-progressors in the panel C. But I want to point out that we looked at two time points, one close to the onset and one remote from the onset. And these proteomic changes were there 2 years before the onset. And this 23 biomarker panel was made up of a lot of innate immune pathways, toll-like receptor signaling, interferon gamma, and so on. Okay, my time is running out. How would you manage this? Vote on management. Tell her not to worry. Come back if she develops joint symptoms. Lifestyle modification. All the things that Dr. Gomer talked about, recessions. Start her on a DMARD or biologic, dietary modification. Start her. There's a redundancy there. Let's just wait till see what people's appetite is for that. Okay, lifestyle modifications wins the day. Diet, smoking, and so on. Good luck with getting people to stop smoking. But certainly, the dietary modifications are important. I just want to bring this, just in the last few minutes, highlight how the VITAL study, 26,000 Americans supplemented with omega-3 and vitamin D to look at cardiovascular endpoints done through Joanne Manson in Boston, and cardiovascular and cancer endpoints, back-to-back New England Journal of Medicine papers, but 5 years ago, nothing. But a secondary analysis by Dr. Kostenbader, also at the Brigham and Women's, looked at autoimmune diseases, and lo and behold, the supplementation with omega-3 and vitamin D, there was appeared to be a significant reduction in the incidence of autoimmune disease, particularly rheumatoid arthritis. So this is something important to keep in mind. And again, if you add other anti-inflammatory supplements, maybe we'll do better. What do patients want? Those with symptoms will do preventative therapy more so than those without symptoms. There's a more appetite for oral than injectable medications. The willingness to take prevention is based on the risk. If you tell somebody you got a 7% risk, they're much less likely to take anything. If you tell them they got a 40% risk, they're more likely to take that. The predicted efficacy is quite important. If you tell somebody in 5 years you're going to be able to reduce your risk from 60% to 25%, they're much more likely to take something than if you say we're going to go from 60 to 45%. This reluctance is really important because it precludes people from participating in studies. In one study, a quarter of the eligible patients didn't participate because they didn't want to take anything. And then we did some focus groups, and there was much more of an appetite for natural foods and supplements and so on. I want to finish off with just this. This just got published by Jeff Curtis. Number of months ago, is how you communicate this risk to individuals is really, really important. And they make the point that you increase awareness about bias, use absolute risks rather than relative risks, avoid the one in X format because people think, well, that's going to be me, you know, that's going to get this. Give them something along the lines of, on the right side of the panel there, where you show them a visual of all the people that won't develop disease versus the people that will develop cancer, in this case, a JAK or TNF inhibitor. Okay? In this case, I would recommend lifestyle changes, smoking anti-inflammatory. I'd bring her back in 6 months. If her CCP is higher, and particularly if she's developed rheumatoid factor, but still has no symptoms, I'd bring her back again. If the CCP is higher and she has symptoms and or rheumatoid factor, I would do what I did with the first case, which is I'd recommend methotrexate, maximally tolerated doses, and then taper after a year. So the take home, currently existing pharmacologic agents delay, but do not prevent RA onset. Risk to benefit considerations and overtreatment of a substantial number of individuals who may be before the point of no return is the price you have to pay. It has to have acceptable risk to benefit ratio. And then the point we just made about communication. So these are my acknowledgements. Lots of people helped with this work, so thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this reprise session from Room Now Live 2024. This session and these recordings were sponsored by AbbVie, UCB, and Amgen. Be sure to register for Room Now Live 2025 when you can have full access to all the videos, all the recordings, all the downloads, and all the board questions that come out of Room Now Live 2025.